This week on the Design Review, we talk about navel-gazing products and the designs that put the customer last.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Design Review. My name is Jonathan and with me is Chris. This week, Chris has put together an interesting topic for us around self-serving design. And Chris, what was the spark for this week's episode?
Yeah, well, actually, this week's topic actually comes from a conversation that we were having.
Wow, sounds like you were talking to a really smart guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, like in show 100, we talked about how like a lot of our topics sometimes just get spawned from us chatting.
And oftentimes like our pre-show chat, we're like, another good episode.
Yeah.
And we've never done this, by the way. Like we've never, ever, ever done self-serving design. You know, we're perfect.
Yeah. Right.
I just want to put that caveat out there before we get going.
Yeah. I mean, clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why you had to say that.
You know.
But yeah, I mean, this topic comes directly from a conversation that we were having right before one of our previous episodes. And what happened was actually, it was because of after we recorded an episode, John, you had sent me a link to your file located on a cloud storage service that I don't want to name. I don't want to shame them. But the thing about it was, you know, instead of just, you know, emailing me directly using Gmail or whatever, I think you use like the whatever share file option from the service, which, you know, was supposed to have sent me an email with a link. And I was looking for your files and, you know, I remember asking you like, hey, you know, just send me the file whenever you have it ready. And you were like, yeah, I already sent it to you. And I was like, what?
Yeah. Like, and that's like the main thing with these like collaborative file sharing services. It's like, I want you to like, make sure you get this shared link. And I know it'd be nice if like, it even let me know, like if you got it or something, right? It's not even doing that.
And so I checked my email and I looked through everything and like I even, you know, typed in various different keywords to try and search my inbox and literally nothing came up. And so when we were talking about it, I was like, you know, this XYZ service seems to have really gone downhill in recent years. And we had a whole conversation about this service and then in general, this topic.
Yeah, this particular service had gone through like a very big redesign a while back, and it was a very beloved product before that.
Yeah.
And then it went through this big redesign and it just felt very self-serving. It didn't feel like, you know, it was going to meet the end user needs at all. And it alienated a lot of their user base.
Yeah.
And I heard that from a lot of other people as well. And so, yeah, that this is what really sparked the conversation for us was like, yeah, why do products keep doing that? Like, because this is also a place that I would have loved to work in the past. And I really looked up to for a long time. Like, I think there's a lot of intelligent designers and people there. And so,
yeah, still, you know, there.
We shouldn't ask like, oh, why are they so bad? But it's like, how could I end up in the same position? Because I don't think there are better or worse designers than I am. So it's a really important to ask like, okay, well, what gets you to that point so you can avoid that?
Yeah. So that's basically what we're talking about today. So this topic of self-serving design. And so we sort of introduced already what it is, but basically self-serving design is this type of design that puts the needs of the company ahead of the needs of the customer.
And I would tack also onto that, like the needs of the designers who feel like, you know, there's maybe like that the importance of them being either unique or interesting or, you know, really crafting a well-polished design over the core product being useful to their users.
Right. Yeah. It's basically, like shifting the focus.
It's pretty much just like, yeah, a bunch of things can actually be kind of over that. And really that needs to be the top. And I think that's sort of like the underlying, you know, reason for all of this is like you get your priorities out of whack and yeah. It can be like at the top could be business goals. And like they put too much emphasis on those business goals and they get lost in that. And just like hyper focused on that one thing. And then the user base, the experience kind of all get lost in the process. And suddenly, you know, their company is lost from under them. Or it could be design, it could be a bunch of other things. But it's really just like that mismatch around like what they're focused on as a company.
Yeah. Yeah. As a company, you know, starts to grow or as the business grows, sometimes the focus, you know, starts to point inwards rather than staying on, you know, outwards, you know, on the customer and prioritizing their needs over the needs of, you know, the internal company politics or the different sort of aspects of the organization. And that's what happens. And so I've written down like a few things to talk about here. So one of the big hallmarks that I wrote down of this type of product is when you notice that the information architecture of the product starts to reflect the company org chart. And this sort of thing isn't necessarily like a bad thing right from the start, because, you know, it sort of makes sense in a way to put certain individuals with particular expertise in roles where they get to utilize that knowledge to the biggest benefit, right?
But yeah, like so for example, like, oh, this is our support designer. Oh, this is our navigation and design systems designer. Oh, this is our, you know, core product designers. And then over here's this feature, designer A, designer B, and designer B for features A, B, and C. You know, it kind of gets like that, but it can be even bigger than just a designer. It can be like whole teams. It can be even like huge, you know, product areas and things like that if you have a really big company.
Yeah. And so, yeah, over time, this type of situation, it can actually, you know, sort of fester and rot because, you know, the group that was maybe small enough to address a particular need sort of then gets tasked with this other thing, which is what are the new features you're adding this year to this thing, you know? And so, yeah, and this is also relates to how, product silos get created because now you've created this group that only does this one thing and they don't, you know, they're so busy with, you know, shipping new features to this thing that they don't really talk to the other people in the company. And then you've just created a whole silo around that. And then you probably also have like four or five other things that are siloed off together.
Yeah. And it's like a tale as old as time where like,
yeah,
you know, you people love this product and everybody falls in love with it. But then this like feature bloat just keeps pouring in over and over again, like new features and changing things that people already liked a lot. And then, you know, either like another product, like a startup comes out with like a very minimal product, probably not even by choice, but because they have to start with a minimal product and everybody loves it. You know, like I see this all the time with like email products. Like everybody's oh man, like I don't want to use this email, you know, provider anymore. I'm going to go like, there's this new email client and then they fall in love with it and it either gets acquired or it gets bloated.
Yeah. And yeah, like, you know, this one little feature, you know, it gets bloated because, you know, now it has like a budget and a roadmap and, you know, like annual goals that it has to achieve and, you know, revenue targets and things like that. And so, yeah, what happens when you have lots of silos is you end up also with lots of stratification, right? So you're dealing with very deep and complex, company hierarchies that then become difficult to navigate, which then turns like very simple tasks, like how do we update this little thing? You know, it becomes a lot more complicated because now you're navigating, you know, this whole like org chart.
We'll talk to this team, get approval. Yeah. Or, you know, you're going to need to talk to this person. And then they're, you know, you're going to have to like, they have to get it on their roadmap. You can't just, your team can't even work on it. You know, they have to get it on their roadmap and you're going to have to wait half a year or a year.
Yeah. And they have to approve it, you know.
They have to approve it. Or, yeah. And like what really should be happening, like an ideal scenario. Obviously, when you get really big in anything, whether it's a product or a company, there's a lot of additional complexities that you get. But you know, like what really should be happening is like sometimes there's a part of your product that's hyper optimized and either needs to have like a long term research to figure out what the next best thing is, or like the best like bang for your buck is to move those people onto like some other areas that are really important that could really add a lot of revenue for the company. But instead, like they sometimes, you know, company politics or, you know, management doesn't really identify that, and they can get like entrenched, and then they really just want to hold on to that. Like we own this entire money-making thing and we're going to optimize it and we're going to keep pushing it until it's doubled. And it's like, there might not be, sometimes, you know, there's market saturation and there's like feature saturation where it's like, this product is only going to serve X amount maximum value to customers and can only like extract that much value. So like sometimes it's going to be a lot more productive for the team. I'm not saying they might be able to squeeze out another percent or two, but it might be more productive for those teams to move on to other things.
Yeah.
So that this doesn't happen.
Well, it's like diminishing returns, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Eventually, you know, you sort of cap out on how much you can really get from a product or a feature or whatever. And anything more you do is just going to require tons more effort than it took to just get it created. Mm. And you're probably not going to get that much additional benefit out of it.
You know, and this is also where we see dark patterns coming in, because then the only way to really get those numbers to move is to use a dark pattern, which, as we've discussed in past shows, all it really does is shift the cost around, like, sort of tricks you into thinking that you're being successful. In reality, you're shoving those implications of those choices a little bit farther down the road, or they bubble up somewhere else, and so those can be tacked on at this point in time as well.
So I wrote down a few things also just to like help people think about this and what they might encounter, you know, when they see this type of thing. So one of the things is like, obviously, like feature factors. We sort of talk about this where, you know, a VP might come by and be like, well, what are the new features we're adding this year kind of thing? And then, you know, you have to scramble to figure out like, what are all the different things we could add?
Yeah.
You know, another thing is, you know, if somebody, I've actually heard this before in meetings, but if somebody actually says something like, you know, somebody somewhere might actually use this, you know,
yeah,
it's like, one, it's like, you should probably figure out who that is, because somebody somewhere isn't really a customer. Right.
Yeah. Everyone, we want everyone to use this.
Yeah. And then this other idea of like somebody somewhere might use this. I mean, is that really a justification for committing resources to building something? I mean, I wouldn't think so, but you know, sometimes people decide that it is, and that's related to the feature factories thing.
That reminds me, I think another source of this, like you said, like you just mentioned, like the executive saying like, what do we need to build next, is sometimes like putting too much importance on customer feedback, which sounds really bad. So let me keep going. But, you know, like the amount of people who are saying that, right? Like you get like, oh, you know, we had a customer say this. It's like, okay, that's great. Let's investigate that. But oftentimes what happens is like a customer said this, so we're going to do this. Or, hey, we had somebody on the team say this, or we had an executive, you know, use the product and they had this experience and like run with that. And that becomes like an entire feature change or feature or something, when you need to go through the step of validating that's a problem and how many people it affects. And is it worth your time? You know, what's the feasibility and impact and all that. So
yeah,
that can be another thing, is like just too, or another side of that is you rely on big customers and one of your big customers says that this is what they want. So you just build exactly what they said they want.
Yeah.
Without going through the whole process of really understanding the need behind it and how does it fit and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And what you said in the first point, I think reminded me of situations where I've dealt with that, where oftentimes like an executive might say something in a meeting, and then a whole bunch of like other managers, you know, who were in that meeting, then scramble resources to try and put out some fire. But what actually is happening is this game, you might remember from kindergarten, called Telephone, where, you know, what the person actually said isn't actually what they said, right? And so,
yeah, or the importance, like they just were commenting, and they, you know, they were sort of just like, you know, talking it out or something. I've heard that from CEOs so many times. They're like, you know, people, like, you have to be really careful what you say in meetings, because then they'll go off and like change the roadmaps to build it. And we don't necessarily want that. We just want to provide input, and then it needs to be properly weighted. But people really freak out when like executives like are saying something, you know, you finally get some FaceTime with them and they're like, oh, but why is that there? And they're like, you know, texting you, the designer, in the meeting, like, we need to change this right now. You know,
so-and-so said this, go make it happen.
The wrong spot, it shouldn't be there. You know, and maybe they haven't gone through all the research and iterations and testing and thought process and that you have, and you just need to like bring them with you. But usually it's like, they just react.
Yeah.
And so if that becomes company culture, obviously that happens, but if that becomes company culture, this can start to really draw the whole company inward, and that ends up revealing itself in the product.
Yeah. Another thing that I've heard from time to time is, you know, when a manager or somebody's like, I'll know it's good when I see it, which is like
the exact opposite from like the scientific method, I think.
It's
if you perfectly inverse, you get this.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, first of all, like, who decided that you were the decision maker, outside of, you know, maybe you have a bigger, you know, paycheck than me. You know, it's like, what qualified you as the person? And two, it's like, you know, how do we make sure that what you're saying is actually in line with what people need, right? Like, we don't know. We don't have a way of knowing, you know, just because you looked at something and decided it was better than something else.
By the way, this is also why working at a startup, you often feel like, I'm going to go work at a startup so I have more leeway. Sometimes this exact thing is why it's really tough to be a designer at a startup.
Yeah, it's just because, in general,
like you said, why you? And it's like, oh, this is the founder or something.
Yeah,
you
know?
Like,
right.
They're like, oh, I own the entire 100% of the company or something. You're like, ooh, okay, yeah. But it's still wrong. So I want to help you make yourself money here. So
yeah. And then another thing is, just increasing product complexity. It's connected to all this feature factory stuff, but generally, like, you know, just recognizing that a product is starting to get really complicated, is a way to start figuring out whether or not, you know, you're really in the deep part of this.
Yeah.
Because it feels complicated to use.
You know, this also reminds me of like how important or how impactful, team churn is, like, employee churn, like, where once you get a complex enough product, that seniority is paramount, because it takes so long to really understand the lay of the land and then the complexity of how that works together and how, like, it you know, how those different pieces affect the customer and the market. That takes a long time to put in your head and get going. Like, I've seen this so many times where, like, you know, team members moving off and like all that knowledge goes with them.
Yeah.
And then a new person comes in and makes these really big changes without knowing the history of what went on with that, or like, you know, what previous thinking was done or why those decisions were made. And then all that good work gets undone because, you know, they're working on, you know, this page and they just like decide to refresh it and nobody really checks that, and then it ships.
Yeah. You know, which leads to additional complexity, or, you know, additional new feature factories, additional silos, additional, you know, everything.
Yeah, or like that self-serving design where it's like, they just don't know what they should know. And so within that ignorance, they get a worse design. And so the product starts to get worse and worse and worse, because there's so much complexity to know to do a good job, even on a small part, that iteratively over time, the product gets worse.
Yeah. So yeah, that was one thing around, you know, product silos and features and things like that. Another area that I wrote down that, you know, can be a marker for this type of thing is when a company starts to sort of overdo it with marketing tricks. And I'm using that in quotations, right? And again, just like with sort of silos and hierarchies, it's not necessarily bad in itself, right? Like every product needs marketing, rather, you know, even really good products, right? Like the iPhone still needed marketing. So you can't sort of do without marketing altogether. But they're like all this stuff, there can come a point of diminishing returns. And once a lot of these sort of significant growth opportunities get used, a lot of times they get replaced with lots of little tactical things where people try and squeeze out, you know, a half a percent here or, you know, a couple percentage here and there just to try and get something. And really, they don't really like move the needle that much. And so what are some things? So one is like, you know, I just wrote down email lists. So like generally like people using email lists both as a way to like collect data about their customers, but also, you know, as sort of data that they could sell to, earn a little bit more money, you know?
And since these are all tied together, like that affects your transactional emails, which I think may have been one of the issues with our problem at the top of the show where we tried to share a file with you, is they might have been, you know, just pushing all these different emails and different, and like the number of emails, even if they're transactional, just becomes too much for people when they unsubscribe. And like that ends up triggering, you know, spam flags and things like that, which impacts the overall experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Like who knows how they used, you know, my email, right? Because in theory, it could just be like as simple as send the file to this other user, but I don't, you know, who knows what they did with it, and who knows where that, like, you know, that email is sitting, because it might have been sent somewhere.
It's in file heaven.
Yeah. But yeah, like email lists, you know, they get used in lots of different ways in various different companies. And depending on, you know, what the product is, you know, sometimes these are pretty nefarious things that, you know, get used or abused. Or like the other situation that I'm reminded of is, you know, when you sign up for things and you uncheck the, you know, send me marketing email stuff, but they still send it to you anyway.
Yeah.
You know, even though you clearly said, I don't want it.
It's like, anyways. You said this type of marketing. This is a different type.
Yeah. So yeah, another thing to sort of notice is when companies also have like free trials where they require a credit card. You know, internally, these are things, you know, you obviously, as a business person, you want that credit card number so that you can just roll them over into a subscription or whatever at the end of the free trial. And you sort of spin it as a convenience feature because, you know, hey, maybe they just forgot to cancel their trial, or maybe they really loved the product at the end of the free trial. So why not just make it easy for them to just start paying us? But in all reality, for the customer, you know, providing a credit card to use a free trial is really not that important to them.
Yeah, right?
They just want to kick the tires a bit. Yeah, it's not really free at that point. Right?
There's actually a few countries now that you're not allowed to say it's a free trial if it requires a credit card. So, I mean, I think like that those patterns are getting snipped away because they don't make sense for users.
Yeah. Yeah. And then certainly related to this would be like important features that are locked behind paid upgrades. I've certainly seen that in a lot of different places where, like, you know, these sort of microtransaction type things where, you know, you're using something, even if you pay for it, you're using this product. And then if you want this extra thing that is actually kind of useful, it's like, oh, you got to pay an additional, you know, $10.99 per month on top of your subscription.
It really starts to feel like they're like antagonizing the user at some point. Like as a user, you feel like the company like really doesn't like you or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because it's, there'll be like these changes. Like, obviously, like if there's certain ways to do like locked upgrades that just feels like natural, like, okay, you know, like this is the next, you know, big jump. And like, it feels like a big jump. And, but there's ones where it's like, doesn't feel fair. It doesn't like, they, and it's like iterative. Like they might take things away from you when you already had. And like, you're like, how could they make these decisions? And usually the reaction is like, you get this big, like blowing up online. Like I'm thinking about like Netflix right now, like they're changing their price again. And a lot of people are really mad about it and things like, how could they get to these certain decisions without really understanding what the impact would be? Is because exactly like what some of these things happen, like we talked about earlier around, you know, the way the company's set up and things like that. And then they start to, you know, put the business needs before the user's needs. And they're like, oh, you know, like, why do we just give this away to people? Like people are willing to pay for it. That's a really big feature. Let's make that a locked, you know, feature that they have to pay for. And they make these decisions because they're not thinking about the user anymore at all. They're thinking about the numbers and they're thinking about the business. And they've totally forgotten about like, we should be giving more to the user, more value to the user than we're getting for a good relationship. And they've just completely put that out of their minds.
Yeah. Like you mentioned Netflix, right? Like, what was it I read? Like they want to charge people for sharing their accounts or something like that.
But yeah, like, so they're increasing the price. And then also it's making it a lot more difficult to like, to have multiple people use the same account. So that also I've heard like affects a lot of even just average users who are just trying to switch between devices as they go from, you know, the living room to like the bathroom to like another room. And like, they're trying to switch between devices. It's like, you know, it lags behind a little bit. So it's like, oh, you're using three. And like, no, I'm just watching on one, but I've switched to between three. So like, it just starts to create a bad taste in the mouth of users. They're like, are you on my team? How much value am I getting? They start to question the relationship. Like, am I getting enough value out of you? If it doesn't feel fair, and if it doesn't feel, again, like they are getting more value out of you than they're giving via dollars. And that's a very important tipping point, because as long as that's, you know, I think even zero, there's going to be a lot of people debating, but like, as long as that's even on the other side, people are going to be willing to pay. You might lose a few, but once that tips over, they're going to start spilling out and really, fleeing the product. And, you know, I think we might see that in the future if this keeps going with like Netflix or some other products where it's like, you've really taken for granted your user base.
Yeah.
And you have to think about like that value to payment ratio.
Right. Yeah. And especially, you know, technically for them, it probably doesn't cost them very much to allow people to switch between devices or switch between, you know, like have a couple different accounts or a couple different people on the same account streaming this, you know, different movies and stuff, right? Technically on the back end, there probably isn't that big of a difference between what's happening, right? And it's just that they want to try and extract, as I mentioned earlier, like they want to try and squeeze out as much dollars as they can out of the people that they have while they're still paying customers, right? And that's what's kind of behind it.
Yeah. And also I think another thing that just triggered in my head was like another reason we haven't talked about why these things can happen to a company or a product is also like when a company goes public and now the ownership of the company is like a shared group that is interested not in the product but in the growth of the company, then it becomes growth for the sake of growth and not for the sake of the health of the company.
Yeah.
And so you get
the stock
you get some,
price.
Yeah. So that it's funny because like it would serve them well to like to not do that, but it's hard like in the aggregate to get people to like make those kind of decisions. But you know they start to think about like the stock price needs to keep going up versus like we need to like build a long lasting healthy company, and so it's always about like what's going to make the numbers go up against like you know adding prices and adding these things. These are you know. How willing are people to do that? Like how close can we push it? And that's really what's going to like, it is going to drive a lot of revenue, but at some point it's going to hurt the company in a very significant way. And so that's another way that this can happen. And oftentimes, you know, they go public and it happens over time. And we get scared of our favorite products going public for that reason.
Yeah. Another thing that I wrote down is products that make you sort of opt out of everything, right? Rather than, you know, like that auto like opt-in sort of thing where like you have to tell them like, I don't want to be part of this whatever thing, you know, rather than asking whether you want to join, you know, like I mentioned, like when you sign up, you know, and they might auto subscribe you into like a bunch of marketing emails or, you know, various things like that where, you know, they put the burden on you as a user to figure out how to like opt out, you know, all the time. Yeah, another thing that I wrote down, was companies offering like fake discounts, meaning like, companies where they might like mark up a product
and then discount it.
Yeah, and say, hey, we'll sell it at 20% off, which is basically the regular price.
Yeah. It's like, it's never been the price that they've crossed out. It's never, yeah. Not at any point has it ever been that price.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like MSRP, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Normally this price, this product is $2,000, but we'll give it to you for, you know, $100. but yeah. And of course, you know, dark patterns. When we talk about marketing, obviously, like, there's a point at which these sorts of tactical things, they sort of cross over into dark patterns and, you know, things like roach motels and a lot of the things we talked about earlier when we were talking about cognitive psychology, you know, using misdirection and things like that to get people to sign up to things because, you know, at this point they've sort of squeezed out everything that they could have done with maybe, you know, semi-legitimate tactics. And now they're just like, well, we don't know what else to do. You know, so we'll just make it impossible for you to cancel.
Yeah. Again, it's like this, like antagonizing the user, almost like it's us versus them and we're trying to get the most money out of them. And we're trying to figure that out versus like, how can we build them more value that they feel, you know, that so that they'll give us more money. And it's usually like the existing product, like let's squeeze every dollar out of them. I keep coming back to like that mismatch. Like it's important to have, obviously the business can only exist if it's making money. And like, we do want businesses to grow. It's like finding that right balance. And as soon as the, you know, that priority of like user value and respecting the user gets pushed too low, this company goes and starts going into these spirals where they become self-serving and eventually customers don't want to pay for that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I mentioned, you know, marketing is essential. You know, you have to have marketing, even for really good products. Products that are, you know, impeccably designed still have to have marketing because they just don't, they don't normally just sell by themselves as much as, you know, as much as that would be ideal. You still have to promote them. You have to sort of talk about them in different ways, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what marketing is for. It's just that at some point, you know, it crosses over from being something that's good for the company and being, you know, good for the customer to something else where it's just like, hey, we're going to nickel and dime you for, for everything we can get kind of thing. those were a couple of like major sort of topic areas, but I don't know if you had any other thoughts. I wrote a couple other things down. One of them being, the sort of like, and I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but this idea of like, consistency. So, what I'm talking about is like with Google products. Sorry, John.
It's okay.
But Google did a big sort of overhaul of their UI, like not too long ago, where they made like all of their UI and icons the same pretty much. And, I still find it very hard to like find stuff in Google now because like, well, yeah, the icons from before were like maybe not consistent and they didn't really look like they came from a single company. I at least knew the difference between like Google Calendar and Google Drive and Gmail. You know, it was easy to find those things because the icons themselves were recognizable. Whereas now when I try to like get access to all my stuff in Google, it's like, I can't figure out like which one is which because they all have the same color palette. They all have roughly the same shape, you know, and they're very hard to differentiate. And you have to like spend a lot of time looking through, you know, all these different applications just to make sure you click the right thing.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen this so many times in like logo redesigns of companies. Like they want to, you know, there's valid reasons why you need to refresh your brand or something if it's not, you know, matching the market that you're after or, you know, what have you, right? So there's it's not like obviously not all redesigns are bad. And sometimes we really liked the old one or something, but they have a very good reason. But also what we see is that like this gets sent out to like an agency or an internal team who just gets like carried away in their own little world without really thinking about like what is the utilitarian purpose of this logo, right? And they're like talking about the universe and they're talking about the meaning of these colors and casting like this huge like vision. It's like, no, this is a container for the brand. Yeah. That's all a logo is. It's a container for the brand. And like they get way too off from where they, like, their target even customers are, you know, like or either their existing or their target customers. Like they've missed both of them. And they just sort of like come up with this insane design. Or like sometimes it's like the emperor with no clothes. And like it comes out and it's like essentially like a sans serif font typing out the logo. And that's it. And they're like, this is the new logo. And they have all this like amazing like explanation about the math and the golden ratio and, and string theory. And you're like, but it doesn't work that well. It's low contrast or like, you know, and like, why does that happen so often? Is like, you get in those meetings. I've been part of like some rebranding of like some medium size, like 500 people company type things where it started out with the internal team and then we handed off to an external team. And like, I can see like, it's very fun and very exciting to work on like a logo brand and think about it and thinking about it being the next Nike and thinking about it being the next like Apple and things. But at the end of the day, like you really need to think about it as a tool for a purpose, right? And you know, we talk even like, you know, Marissa Mayer, that story of her like with you know inviting a bunch of designers over the weekend trying and like, you know, coming up with a new Yahoo logo. And that did not go well. Right? Like it can get really self-serving where you're not like again it's not bringing in the customer at the top of the of this priority list. And so you come up with the wrong solution because it's not serving your customers who are paying you at the end of the day. That's the business, is the customer being happy. That's why it's first, not the business. Right? Like people always ask me like, okay, well, why would the business not be first? Like you have to make money as a business in order to be a business. Otherwise you go out. But yes, that's true. It's not disappearing from the list. It's just second because you can always save a business or grow a business that's putting their customers first. And you can always like tweak that up a little bit if it's not working out. But like as soon as the customer is not first and falls down below the other items on the on that list, it's a downward spiral from there. It's only a matter of time because it becomes self-serving and users don't find value and they leave and that's the end of the story.
And just like with everything, like this the point about, you know, Google's consistent, you know, forced imposed consistency, you know, as we know, as designers, consistency isn't really like the main point, right? Like it's good that products have consistent things in them. What happens here is that, you know, it's some sort of forced or imposed consistency rather than just naturally, you know, thinking about, you know, what is consistent and how do we make things, you know, that make sense in a consistent way. You know?
It's like it's too shallow of a goal, right? It's like consistency needs to be is fine as a tool to get you to the next thing. Like is consistency gonna help with recognition or are people confused with the consistency? So it's like, if there's not a problem, it's like a solution in search of a problem. That's a problem. But, you know, I think that's a great point.
Another one that I wrote down is similar to what we were talking about, which is just sort of generally, well, I'm going to call it out. It's like just generally like Adobe product. well, I mean, I was using this like Adobe app to access some digital documents and like just like I literally spent probably about like 7 hours trying to get it to work. It didn't work. It still hasn't worked. You know, a few days later it still doesn't work. So like there's something about this to me that is just like I don't know what is going on in that company, but I feel like they like there's other things around, like, you know, the product is not working. There's things like, you know, people find it very difficult to cancel Creative Cloud, for example. You know, all kinds of things about this company that really point at this sort of self-serving, self-interest, like business model that they use. And yeah, like maybe, you know, not to totally dump on them, but like, yeah, like I get that, like, you know, Photoshop is still sort of useful in certain ways and Illustrator is useful in certain ways and et cetera, et cetera. But what they've done, you know, is they've made it kind of impossible, in my opinion, to really be sort of a proud customer of the business, right? Because like I, you know, personally, I will not use Adobe products anymore just because of the way they conduct themselves. But, this idea that, like, you know, it's difficult to cancel Creative Cloud, right? Like that's one, it's a classic Roach Motel. But it's like, if you were really a business acting in the interest of your customer, it's like, yeah, if somebody wants to cancel, you should just let them cancel. You know, what's the problem there? And I don't know, I don't know how else to say that, but
yeah, I mean, if your customer, it only benefits you to leave on good terms, right? Like,
yeah,
if you're ever leaving a company, you don't just go around being like, and this is what I think about you, and this is what I think about this. Like, there's no benefit to you. You might work with them in the future. Like, you might not feel that way tomorrow. And there's a million reasons. And yet, like, we do this a lot as products where, you know, as soon as somebody's about to leave, we find, again, this viewing the user as like a cog in your machine, right? Versus like being the top priority. Is like, you then as soon as they stop providing you value, you don't value them anymore, right? And so like they go through all these dark patterns, or they make it really difficult to cancel, or they, you know, try to charge you fees and all this kind of stuff because they don't value their customers. Yeah. They don't respect their customers, and their customers feel that on the way out. And so not only it could just be like a very cordial, like, okay, I'm no longer needed. Okay, great. Well, you know, when you do, let us know. Yeah. Versus like, hey, you know, now that you've stopped or you've even thought about it, you know, we're going to reveal our true colors and really like, you know, hurt you. So then now you have somebody who is not only never coming back, but now they are a huge proponent of like telling people that they shouldn't use your product and how bad it is. And they have like anger and passion around that. Yeah. So you have like a detractor out there in the world telling people not to subscribe. So like that's a big deal. You want to do a great job on the exit.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. We could keep talking about Adobe, I guess.
Yeah, the episode's getting kind of long.
But so I thought, you know, like I put down some other points on just asking this question, like, why does this stuff sort of happen? Right? Like, why, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, what it is, what are some examples of this? So why does this stuff actually happen out there? And aside from, I don't know, I wrote down some things like, you know, first of all, businesses reaching a certain size, and then they end up sort of de facto doing this because that's what all big companies end up doing somehow. But it's true. I mean, I think, you know, businesses, once they reach a certain level of growth, or once the company itself, you know, has reached a certain amount of employees, it starts to get in this pattern of like, hey, let's make things really complicated. We'll be very, very self-serving and really put the customer second, or last.
Yeah. It's like this cases. Pride you get when you're, you know, over a very, rich, not productive, but like you're over a product that's making a lot of money.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pride that comes with that, and, you know, and then it comes and you kind of feel like, okay, we know best. And it can be also that survivorship bias of like, yeah, we did something and now this company has, you know, grown into a multi-billion dollar company or whatever.
Yeah.
And they don't really realize what specifically, you know, there was some luck there, or, you know, which specific things they did in the past that actually affected the growth. And so since they don't really know, but they think they know, they end up driving it back down to the ground.
Yeah. Another one is like high management getting sort of insulated from reality. This is something that I feel like I've seen quite a bit, but you know, it's like, it's related to the sort of the company size thing where like, you know, some executive management, you know, they're having a big meeting with, you know, all the executives, and like all the different other managers are going in there and, you know, presenting metrics to try and, you know, make themselves, you know, look productive or look like they had a successful year and basically yeah. get more budget. Right.
Oh, yeah. It was so crazy. Like, sorry, like at one of my past companies, I think they did this actually really well, where like there was just so much truth. Like it was such a culture thing, like that everybody, there was so much truth that it was so refreshing. We're like, we'd talk about like what, you know, just here's what's going really poorly and here's what's going well. And it just felt like facts versus like, there's so many other companies I've been in, and I've been guilty of it too, where it's like, you always want to present the best face possible. Even if it's not, that's like, you're not seeking the truth about like how successful was this versus like what we could have done. Like you're just like, always, everyone's always buttoning up everything they did and making it sound like a massive success.
Yeah.
And it can be like really focused around the way that you promote or reward your career growth and things like that, where like people are no longer thinking about like what's best for the company or what's best for the customer. They're thinking about like what's best for me and the company, because like, you know, they don't feel part of like the group, or they're not incentivized correctly. So then what do? They're like serving the people who are going to give them the promotion, or they're trying to like, you know, save a face in front of those people. And so the truth gets totally lost.
Yeah. And so, yeah, like, and you know, as an executive, they might actually want to know some factual information, but if, you know, if they're getting just these like metrics that, you know, only tell a certain side of the story, you know, they don't have a chance at really being able to understand what's happening. And then, you know, everything else sort of spirals out of control from there, because then they're making decisions that affect the business, you know, based on the numbers and things that they're seeing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a clear sign of things. and then, yeah, again, related to that is generally just, you know, a company that has a focus on making metrics that look good rather than products that serve people well. And I think that's an important distinction to note.
And so many people at the company not understanding metrics. I think this is like a huge industry-wide symptom. I've been guilty of for a long time too. And like, the more I learn, the more I'm like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like we're all playing dolls with data. I feel like they don't really know.
And like, that's the thing. It's like, why do we put so much faith in it then? You know,
because know. Look, number went up. Like, we don't we all kind of like, and also like with like running tests and things like that, where you kind of like need that like statistical like significance, or you need to know like what makes a clean test versus, you know, like you're gonna get mixed signals. Like, so many people don't understand that. And like, I didn't for a long time. And I think most of the industry, I would say, doesn't. And sort of, we're just sort of playing pretend with all this data and trying to like go off of like these weird signals that are not going to lead us towards the North Star. They're just going to lead us somewhere into the woods.
Right. Well, because, you know, like, you know, somebody might have read a book like, okay, we should do A/B testing because the book said, you know, the book had a case study where the person was really successful because they did A/B testing. So then they go find a service that allows them to put A/B testing into the product. And then, you know, they do that. And then now they're like, okay, what now?
Yeah. And the A is like totally different than B. Yeah. And so, and like with totally different time period and a totally different like customer base. And they're like, oh, B did so well. Let's roll that out. And that's definitely, I'm glad you added that one. I think that's definitely a way that you can get lost. And, cause you're pursuing all these metrics you've plugged into, but they're not necessarily telling you what you think they're telling you.
Yeah. Another one is, we sort of talked about this, is where teams grow and then they form sub teams and then sub teams, et cetera, et cetera, you know, to help them focus their effort on certain things, you know, which then, you know, continues to grow or whatever, and then creates even more, you know, stratification within the company, or, you know, constant reorganizations within the company because, you know, we need to make sure we're focused on the right things. And, you know, they reorganize teams and sub teams and this and that. And, you know, none of it really, you know, does the thing that they're actually trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
Which I think then leads to kind of this last point that I want to make, which is basically just companies ignoring research and don't listen to customers because they think they know better.
Yeah, don't do research is definitely on there. Like, and also, you know, a lot of companies and people, I think, don't know how to do research either.
Yeah, they don't know how to do it.
Yeah, yeah, like it's like, oh, we showed this to either five people in the office or, you know, or we showed this to 10 customers or even like 100 customers, but you were asking like the wrong questions or you didn't set up the test properly. It's very difficult. Like these are things that like people go to school for and like, and also like you really need to be like very strict about because otherwise you won't learn the thing you think you're learning. And that's very dangerous is you're getting like data that's wrong. It's like if we're flying an airplane and the controls are telling you the incorrect things. Like that's, you're going to hit the ground. And that happens quite often, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I remember like a while ago in a job interview, I was describing, you know, a research method on how to like learn about like, how do you develop a product? And like the response I got was like, well, we just don't do that. I didn't get the job there because the thing I was talking about was like something that they didn't do and basically, I guess, didn't want to do. But it was just kind of funny to me because it was like their reaction when I said all that was like, well, that's not how we do things. It's like, okay.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. So yeah, do you have any other thoughts on this? Because I don't know if I covered everything sufficiently.
No, I think we covered quite a lot. I mean, like, there's a lot of ways to like explain like the symptoms
the stuff.
And the stuff. But, well, the one I keep coming back to is this mismatch priorities of like the user and respecting the user falling away in the priorities of the company and the teams. Yeah. And that can happen for so many different reasons, like, you know, the company size and the complexity of the product or, you know, even the design team sort of getting carried away in some enjoyable, you know, self-serving design. And at the end of the day, when you lose sight of the customer, you lose sight of the goal and you're going to miss your goal. So just always make sure that every step of the way and also as designers, we're sort of the, you know, obviously everyone should care about this, but we're also the voice of the customer oftentimes, like in conjunction with user research. And so it's our job to say, hey, this product idea or hey, this roadmap doesn't really match with what we're seeing from users or like what we, you know, what users' needs are or something like that. So you can really be the agent of change. Obviously, there's going to be problems that are just, you can't change around like your product complexity and all that. But definitely for the stuff that you work on, you know, making sure that it's sort of following that scientific method, you have a hypothesis, you have a very dependable way to test that and get data about it and iterate on it and making sure that throughout all those different iterations and as you talk to the business side that you're really matching that up with user needs. And you're not just focused on like, hey, we could get more revenue if we did X, Y, and Z. It's really like, well, you know, are we actually getting more value? And sometimes the answer is yes. Like it might feel weird to say that, like, you know, if 10% more people, you know, start a free trial, then that's good for them. It could be good for them, right? Like if somebody comes and enjoys the product and wants to stay, that's great. You know, that's actually something that they want too. It's not, you're not like tricking the customer, right? So there's good, that good revenue that you want to pursue, just making sure that it's like, oh no, they didn't intend to start the, you know, paying. And there's a big difference, right? You want to get to the point where they want to pay you. And that's such a stronger product. That's such a stronger company that you can build off of and you'll see much stronger numbers, if you do that.
Yeah. I mean, it affects all the metrics that you want to change, that you want to see go up, you know, by just being respectful and prioritizing them. Yeah. So the $1 million question, what can we do about this?
Nothing. Go home.
Yeah. Start a podcast.
Start a podcast.
So the first thing I wrote down is simply to just get back to basics and do some research, right? I mean, if understanding the customer is the problem, then putting the effort in to understand the customer is part of the solution, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, things like leading research and customer interviews, these are things that are incredibly valuable, not just because, you know, they help with design, but there's so many things that can feed off of that stuff that comes out of that research, right? And, you know, I talked about this, I think, in the past, but, you know, this idea of like, you know, when people initiate projects, right, they usually have some assumption about what they think might happen, and they just sort of stop there, right? They just let the assumption dictate which direction to go in. And what you can do is actually conduct research to validate whether or not these are the right things to focus on.
Right. Yeah.
It's okay to have assumptions, but at least put in the work to make sure that the assumptions you're making are correct, right? Because otherwise you're committing resources to things that might not be that valuable, basically. And so when you do this research, and we've talked about this before, one of the best things you can do is share your findings with a lot of the people in the company, right? Make sure that people understand what you did and why you did it and what the outcome was. Mm-hmm. And then more importantly, make sure that they don't misunderstand what the outcome was and make incorrect assumptions again.
Yeah, you might have a customer quote that just like blows up and like, we should do this right away. You're like, no, only one customer said that. And yeah, you know, the other, you know, 15 said they didn't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's another power of user research is like when you can get like quotes or you can get clips and things like that.
Video clips, yeah.
It brings the user back to the top and you make much better decisions of like, oh yeah, yeah. You know, these are people we need to respect and we need to provide value. They become real again and you make better decisions when they're real.
Yeah. And like even in companies where like they were really resistant to doing this type of work, and I just did it anyway. It was always much better because people were always like surprised at the outcomes, like what the findings were, because they didn't realize at the time what they were saying no to, you know. And once they saw the stuff and they were like, oh, like, it was obvious, you know, what things we should work on, but also that we ought to do more of this type of research. And so, yeah, it was kind of like I mentioned, like I did it. I would do this stuff anyway, even if people said no sometimes. Because, I in a lot of cases where I did it anyway, it was like really important to be able to do it. And that's where the thing, you know, sometimes you have to just kind of suck it up and be one of those like, you know, I'll beg forgiveness rather than ask permission to do it kind of thing. Research. So another thing I wrote down here, and this is based directly on my experience, you know, having worked in a massive, massive hierarchical organization, I found that there's basically like two things you can do to deal with a very complicated sort of hierarchical structure. And the first thing is just continue escalating until you find the right person within the hierarchy that basically makes the decision, right? If you have a question about this, or if you're trying to develop a feature in the right way and you keep getting no, 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 all you have to do is, I say all you have to do, it's a lot of work, but if you keep escalating, eventually you're going to find the person within the company that says yes to these types of things, right? And once you find them, you know, and you get them to say yes, keep them informed, right? Let them know what the outcomes are so that they understand what they said yes to, and that, you know, you're contributing something to the company and to the business. And so that the next time you come to them, or next time they hear something about this, they know what happened, what to talk about, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Right.
I think that's a really good point, because a lot of times people are kind of scared to talk to anyone else but their manager. Like they'll flag it with their manager or their team, and they feel like that's all they can do. Like, no, like you can cold email your director or, you know, executives, yeah, or even like the CEO sometimes, and like they will be willing to listen. The amount of times like that's worked is like, yeah, too high for me to not recommend it to you.
Yeah.
I've met with like the CEO of like, you know, tens of thousands of people, companies and things like that, just because I emailed them and said like, hey, I would love to talk to you about this thing that I'm, you know, and they, or sometimes they'll even have like office hours, especially for that type of thing. So
yeah.
It gets really nerve wracking when their assistant like responds to you that they want to set something up and all that. But,
yeah,
but you know, like it's, if it's important enough, like definitely like make sure you reach it. Cause like one of the, I heard this all the time from executives, like, and like people who are big managers of managers, you get farther and farther away from the real information. So they, yeah, love meeting with people like that to get a better understanding of like what, especially if you're raising like, hey, this is a problem, and I'm, I just want to like make sure you flag it. And you don't need to say like, hey, we have to do this. All you need to say is like, hey, I want to share with you a problem that I see. And, yeah, you know, we can work together on like, what if it's something we need to pursue or whatever, you know, like you don't need to necessarily come with like, hey, I have all the answers. You can say, hey, I would love to present to you some like data that I'm seeing, and we can talk about what we should do. So yeah, it really makes it a lot less scary, because you're not having to come and say, hey, I'm here, I'm going to come with the answer, and I'm going to prove it, which is really scary. It's like saying, hey, yeah, this is what I'm seeing, I want to share that with you, and then let's talk about it. That's a, yeah, lot less scary. There's no way that can go wrong. There's literally, yeah, no way that can go wrong. You'll always achieve that goal of explaining what you see and talking about it, right? And, yeah, but the number of times that's worked and I've got things to change, or I've got like really big things to change, or, you know, or we just like have better understanding of why that's something we can't change, has been way too high for that, like, not to be a great thing for everyone to do.
Yeah. And, you know, we mentioned, you know, that in, especially in big companies, this game of telephone exists, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is a way to kind of subvert that
direct,
right?
Message,
like, yeah, like you just talk to them, yeah, and you get directly from, you know, the people that can make decisions, you know, what are their thoughts on the things that affect you,
yeah,
rather than, you know, hearing, you know, fifth hand, sixth hand from, you know, messages that have filtered through like, you know, 10 different layers within an organization. You know, you get directly to the source and find out that maybe, you know, what they had said is not at all what what is being told to you.
Yeah.
But yeah, and like I said, keep them informed. I think that is a really important thing that has worked for me as well, is like the follow up and the follow through. You know, because once they know you're out there, they might want to hear back and like, what, you know, what happened with that conversation and what was the sort of outcome and what, you know, where did all this like effort go, kind of thing. It's important to keep people informed.
Yeah.
The other thing, so the first one is about going up. The other thing you can do is drill down, right? Drill down to find people, rather than folks that make decisions, find all the people that get things done.
Yeah.
And basically just build collaboration with those folks. Because you'll find in big companies that not everyone, you know, as much as, you know, there are people, a lot of the time within big companies, there's really like a handful of people that are actually responsible for getting things done.
Yeah.
And you know, this is not to like, you know, criticize any big company. It's just, that's just how it goes a lot of the time. Like, you know, you'll find a team and, you know, there's always like one person, that just gets everything done, and everyone else just kind of like, you know, they work, but you know, it's not the same. Right. Yeah. And so if you can drill down and find those people and build collaboration with those people, you have a much greater chance of kind of executing on the things that, you know, you really want to get done, basically. And, you know, I should also caveat this whole thing is that, you know, you still have to sort of work and collaborate with all of the middle layers, right? So, you know,
yeah,
you can't just like ignore the fact that, you know, all this stuff in the middle is there. you know, you still have to play nice with it. You still have to work with it. But the important thing is to not kill your own timeline, just trying to make sure that all this middle stuff, you know, is happy, right? The important thing is to keep the focus on the customer and work with the people within the company that can actually help you get things done, basically.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll mention here is sort of, we talked about doing upfront research. Well, sometimes in the absence of upfront research, you sort of can make up for the fact that it doesn't exist with just consistent and frequent usability testing throughout the process. And this is something that I've used a few times, many times, because we weren't able to get upfront research done. So what am I talking about? This is like keeping tests, you know, really small scale and focused on understanding a few different things, and just focus the activity on doing a lot of it, like the frequency and repetition, right? So you're just doing a lot of it over a shorter period of time. And make sure, you know, when you do it this way, make sure that you're making changes after the entire test is complete, right? Because you don't want to like skew your results. But the reason why this is effective is you can basically test with fewer people and then just do it a lot, right? And this is where I think it's difficult because people who are generally unfamiliar with this type of qualitative research, they sort of misunderstand this idea of statistical significance, right? When you do it this way, you basically don't need, you know, thousands of people in one test. Or like, you know, the way in which people sort of think about surveys, for example, you know,
yeah,
like surveys, you need a lot of people to get the numbers to look good, right? To get the verifiable results. Well, when you do this, you probably need like six people.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when you're just right, trying to like tease out some usability issues, you don't need them. Like, you know, cause you'll get your point is not to get 100% of all the issues. Your point is to get like a lot of them. And so even with six people, you can get, you can get rid of a ton of, or identify a ton of issues just with those six people. Because you're not looking for that like 100% accuracy, right? You're looking for just like, hey, can you point us at these problems?
Yeah.
And then you can fix them. And then that, it's sort of like the 80-20 rule right there. Like you get a lot of value out of just those six people. And then you can, you know, if the risk is really high, you can increase it.
Yeah, and I can pretty much guarantee you, like, you do, like, two or three rounds of that type of testing, you'll basically have nailed everything down.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take that much work.
It's so funny. Like, oftentimes we'll do 10 people. And so many times, like, it's like the first one, like, whoa, that was amazing. Everyone's, like, talking about all the stuff we learned. The second one, like, oh, yeah, this, and this. And even by the third one, it's like, yep.
It's starting to repeat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, like if you do like, you know, just a few like rounds of testing with different things, you'll basically iron out most of the kinks.
Yeah.
And also the other thing that people misunderstand about this stuff is when you talk about testing and testing prototypes or whatever, people think that you have to do this really complicated, like technical instrumentation of stuff. And it's not really that, right? Outside of the recruiting portion, usability testing isn't really that difficult to do. I mean, you have to sort of understand how to ask questions in the right way and, you know, ask open-ended questions and things like that. But, you know, technically it's not that complicated, right? And the prototypes, you know, the things that you're testing, they don't have to be fully fleshed out products. You know, they can be pretty rough even. Yeah. The main thing is that you're trying to understand qualitatively what people think and how usable things are. So it doesn't even have to be, you know, a finished piece of software. It can be sort of something that is like halfway built, as long as you know how to like deal with the things that are not finished. You know, you can just sort of manage that in the test. And this is things that I've done. Like, you know, I've tested prototypes where, you know, flows weren't fully built out. And when, you know, like most of the time people didn't even get into those like unbuilt areas, And when they did, it was like, oh, we just talked about it for a little bit, and then they understood, you know, what I was trying to do and whatever, you know, it was like a non-issue basically. And so, yeah, you basically get all a ton of very useful information, even within like 1 week of testing. So, usability testing is good. I think like, I don't know, that's mostly about it.
All right. Yeah.
On this topic.
We covered quite a lot. This is a little bit of a longer episode, but hopefully this is helpful in preventing some of this or identifying it in your company. And you can, try to cut that out as quickly as possible and just remain customer centric. And then as you grow in your career, there'll be more and more opportunities to redirect the ship. But even at like the feature level, as you design a feature, like making sure that everything's aligned is part of your job as a team member to call those things out. So now hopefully you have a few more tools to do that. And we will catch you on the next episode. Anything else to add before we wrap up?
Well, the one thing I think I want to leave people with is, you know, if you think it's really risky to do all this like user-centered design and user-centered methods and stuff like that, you know, imagine how risky it is to just keep doing things, you know, in the way that you've been doing them and expecting a much better result, right? Like that just doesn't happen.
Yeah. These user-centered methods are all about like de-risking your choices. Otherwise you're just designing and you're hoping you get lucky, right?
Yeah, it's exactly.
Like, hey, I hope you get lucky, but this way there's a lot of less hope and there's more like you're building knowledge to actually get to where you need to go. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Really appreciate your time. You can find this episode and a bunch of other episodes on anchor.fm/designreview. You can also support us there. There's a button for that. You can also see, you know, all the other different places this podcast can be found, like Spotify or Amazon, and your favorite podcasting app will probably have us as well. You can also find us on Twitter. The podcast is dr_podcast, and I am Design UX UI.
I am Machine Human. Please also leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this right now.
Go
do it right now.
Go.
because it definitely helps get the show out to more people and gets us ranked higher in the algorithms. And lastly, of course, mentorship is available. If you have questions about, you know, your career or how to like get a job, or, you know, if you have particular questions about how to deal with, you know, self-serving design or self-serving organizations, feel free to set up a time on officehoursproject.com. You know, you can go find a mentor and set up a time to talk to them. So, yeah.
All right. Thanks again for your time. Catch you on the next episode. And see you later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
See you later. Sayonara.
Chodafes. Adieu.
All right. I guess.
Adios.
Yeah, yes, that's a good one. We haven't used Spanish in a while.
Yeah.
What else? What other language?
Have you learned your Mandarin yet for Bai?
In Cantonese, it's Cantonese.